We are not in a state where business as usual is appropriate at a time where there are human rights abuses.
U.S. diplomatic boycott of Beijing Winter Olympics. It's Wednesday, December 8th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Chris Casquiel in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, COVID vaccine political divide, where malaria is on the rise, Solomon Islands peacekeeping force, new black hole discovery, artificial intelligence to fight internet censorship. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. will stage a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Winter Olympics in Beijing to protest Chinese human rights abuses, the White House confirmed Monday, a move that China has vowed to greet with firm countermeasures. The dispatching of high-level delegations to each Olympics has long been a tradition among the U.S. and other leading nations. Then-President George W. Bush attended the opening of the 2008 Beijing Olympic Summer Games, and First Lady Jill Biden led the American contingent to the Summer Olympics in Tokyo this year. The diplomatic boycott comes as the U.S. attempts to stabilize turbulent relations with Beijing, even as it maintains a tough approach toward trade and conflicts over China's actions on Taiwan, human rights, Hong Kong, and the South China Sea. White House spokesperson Jen Psaki.
Why not go further and bar U.S. athletes from the Games?
Because not sending a U.S. delegation sends a clear message that we cannot conduct ourselves with business as usual, that we are not in a state where business as usual is appropriate at a time where there are human rights abuses that we have been outspoken about, that we have taken actions on, and we feel this sends a clear message. At the same time, we believe U.S. athletes, people who have been training, giving up a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, preparing for these Olympics, should be able to go and compete, and we look forward to cheering for them from home.
A Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson accused U.S. politicians of grandstanding over the issue of not sending dignitaries to attend events that China hopes will showcase its economic development and technological prowess. Speaking to reporters at a daily briefing, he said such a move would be an outright political provocation, but gave no details on how China might retaliate. Zhao Lijian said, "We are firmly opposed to any words and deeds that politicize sports in violation of spirits of the Olympic Charter. Such behaviors of hyping will only undermine the interests of all athletes." U.S. President Joe Biden will host the White House Summit for Democracy, a virtual gathering of leaders and civil society experts from more than 100 countries that is set to take place Thursday and Friday. The administration has said that Biden intends to use the convening to announce both individual and collective commitments, reforms, and initiatives to defend democracy and human rights at home and abroad. Find more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, is how then-U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt described the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the American naval base near Honolulu, Hawaii. Tuesday marked the 80th anniversary of the surprise strike on the U.S. Pacific Fleet that killed more than 2,400 service members and civilians, wounded about 1,000 people, and damaged or destroyed almost 20 ships and more than 300 aircraft in less than 2 hours. Cass Phillips, a 101-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor, told Dallas station WFAA, "I was 21 at the time.
The wind was blowing that fire towards the Maryland and the Oklahoma, and I didn't want to get in that water. So by the time as I was going over, where the two ships were riveted together, I just made a big leap, and I caught a hold of a line that was hanging over the side of the Maryland, and I hoisted myself aboard the Maryland."
The next day, President Roosevelt asked Congress to declare war on Japan, and the lawmakers approved the move. Just 3 days later, Germany and Italy, Japan's allies, declared war on the U.S. The U.S. reciprocated, entering World War II, which had been raging in Europe for more than 2 years. Also on Tuesday, the U.S. military began reburying the remains of service personnel killed when the USS Oklahoma was attacked in Pearl Harbor, following a year-long project to identify their remains. The burials will be in Honolulu's National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. The Pentagon Project identified nearly 400 service members from the ship with the help of DNA technology and dental records, leaving the remains of only 33 people from the ship not individually identified, according to a report in the Washington Post. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Competition between U.S. and China continues in Africa. International students return to Australia under COVID-19 pilot scheme. Rohingya refugees sue Facebook for $150 billion over Myanmar violence. UN upholds decision denying Taliban and Myanmar junta's requests for representation. UN launches historic $2 billion humanitarian appeal to save Afghan children. Find complete coverage on all these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. Thank you for listening to VOA Asia on this Wednesday. A group of Japanese lawmakers visited a Tokyo shrine Tuesday, viewed by Chinese and Koreans as a symbol of Japanese wartime aggression. More than 100 lawmakers reportedly visited the Yasukuni Shrine for the first time in 2 years since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Victims of Japanese aggression during the first half of the 20th century, especially Chinese and Koreans, see the shrine as a symbol of Japan's militarism because it honors convicted World War II criminals among about 2.5 million war dead. Many South Koreans deeply resent Japan for its colonial rule of the Korean Peninsula from 1910 to 1945. To COVID now, living through a pandemic has been a stressful and difficult challenge. Divisions between the vaccinated and unvaccinated have made the past 2 years even more stressful. Karina Bafrajian reports on both sides and efforts to change minds.
Sometime over the past 2 years, getting a COVID vaccine became a huge point of conflict between Americans. There are websites devoted to shaming people who refuse the vaccine, only to become seriously ill or die from the disease. And there have been reported threats of violence leveled against vaccine advocates and public health experts like Dr. Anthony Fauci. Digging past politics, the fact remains that COVID hits the unvaccinated the hardest, but that fact doesn't seem to be registering. Pier Carlo Valdesolo is an associate professor of psychology at Claremont McKenna College.
What we're seeing with the virus is a highly politicized topic, stoking in-group, out-group sentiments. And one of the dominant ways that people react emotionally to the suffering of out-group members is a muted sense of empathy and, at the extreme, even a sense of pleasure in the pain of out-group members.
Retired Maryland resident Linda Mercer was initially against getting a COVID-19 vaccine. She says her concern rose from the speed with which the vaccine was developed, and relatives and former colleagues shared her skepticism. But that changed in the middle of 2021, when Mercer got the virus. Mercer spent a few weeks in hospital. After she recovered, she and her family got the vaccine.
It made me say, okay, get the vaccine, because if the vaccine could just save you from getting as sick as I did, I'd rather have the vaccine than to catch COVID again.
Experts say Mercer's story shows how vaccine opponents can change the minds of others with similar views.
At least from a psychological perspective, it makes sense that anti-vaxxers would be more compelled by the story of an individual in-group member who is suffering than reading news stories about how many people are dying of COVID every day or how effective a vaccine is.
A study at Brigham Young University suggests that personal stories do more to encourage vaccinations than faceless statistics. In an experiment, students who opposed the vaccine interviewed people who got illnesses that could have been prevented with a vaccine. By the end, roughly 70% of students had changed their mind about vaccinations. Experts say this suggests that education does more to change attitudes about vaccines than does public shaming. For Karina Bafrajan in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Still to come on VOA Asia, why malaria cases are rising in certain parts of the world. Happening now in Asia, a small group of people protested the military government in Mandalay on Tuesday, a day after a special court sentenced the country's ousted leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, to 4 years in prison. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Continuing now with VOA Asia, the World Health Organization reports a significant rise in malaria cases and deaths in 2020 due to COVID-19 disruptions in malaria services. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on WHO's latest World Malaria Report.
Over the past two decades, global malaria death rates have been cut in half, saving the lives of 10.6 million people. New data gathered by the WHO show COVID-19 has stopped and even reversed the progress made in reducing deaths from this preventable, treatable disease. The WHO's World Malaria Report estimates 241 million malaria cases and 627,000 malaria deaths globally have occurred in 2020. This represents an increase of 14 million cases and 69,000 deaths compared to the previous year. WHO links the increase to disruptions of malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment services during the pandemic. Director of WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says the situation could have been far worse. The good news, he says, is that the predicted doomsday scenario did not transpire. He notes gloomy projections made in March 2020 of a huge spike in malaria have not materialized.
One worst-case scenario implied a doubling of malaria deaths. So, let me reiterate this. That is not the case. We can call this a success story, even though an extra 47,000 people have died as a consequence of the disruptions.
The report finds progress in the global fight against malaria remains uneven. Between 2000 and 2020, WHO has certified 12 countries as being malaria-free. Two countries, China and El Salvador, have achieved this status in 2021, despite the ongoing pandemic. Since 2015, both cases and deaths have stalled in most of the world's 93 endemic countries and territories. However, other figures show malaria cases have increased in 32 countries, most in sub-Saharan Africa and some in South America. Alonso says the situation remains especially precarious in Africa, where the malaria burden remains unacceptably high. He notes Africa accounts for about 96% of global deaths, 80% among children under age 5.
And at the same time, the pandemic is not over, and the pace of economic recovery is uncertain. Without immediate and accelerated action, key 2030 targets of the WHO Global Technical Strategy will be missed, and additional ground may be lost.
WHO strategy calls for a 90% reduction in malaria cases and deaths by 2030. It also presses for the elimination of malaria in at least 35 countries and for the prevention of disease resurgence in all countries that are malaria-free. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. India's protesting farmers have received a proposal from the government addressing some of their demands, including minimum support prices for all produce, not just rice and wheat. farm union leaders said on Tuesday. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Welcome back to VOA Asia. A New Zealand police contingent deployed to the Solomon Islands has begun patrols following unrest last month. The violence on the street has eased, but political tensions over the South Pacific archipelago's relationship with China and Taiwan continue. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand police officers and soldiers joined other peacekeepers from Australia, Papua New Guinea and Fiji in an effort to maintain order on the Solomon Islands. They were deployed after a request for international assistance was made by the island's government. The capital, Honiara, is mostly calm after last month's rioting and looting. Many businesses in the Chinatown district were destroyed and at least three people died. The unrest has had various triggers. The protests were led in large part by residents of Malaita province, angered by a perceived lack of accountability and transparency from elected officials. Analysts say the coronavirus pandemic has deepened inequality. Broader geopolitical influences have also fomented unrest. Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare's decision to switch diplomatic allegiances from Taiwan to China in 2019 continues to cause tensions. On Monday, Sogavare survived a no-confidence vote by lawmakers in Parliament. Speaking in Parliament, Matthew Whale, the opposition leader, accused the Prime Minister of being unduly influenced by China.
He's in the service of a foreign power. It is terrible that businesses were looted and destroyed. But it pales, Mr. Speaker, in comparison to the looting happening at the top, at the expense of ordinary Solomon Islanders.
In turn, Sogavare claimed his critics were servants to Taiwan.
The innocent people of Malaita have been lied to by these agents of Taiwan.
Violence between residents of Guadalcanal, a prosperous island that's home to the capital Honiara, and migrants from Malaita Island prompted the intervention of an Australian-led force in 2003. The peacekeeping mission lasted until 2017. The South Pacific nation is home to about 700,000 people, mostly of Melanesian ethnicity. It's unclear how long the current Australian-led peacekeeping efforts will last. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The death toll from the eruption of Indonesia's Mount Semeru volcano rose to at least 34 Tuesday, according to Indonesia's National Disaster Agency. Rescue forces in Indonesia dug out the body of a 13-year-old boy on Monday, as improved weather conditions allowed them to resume their search after Saturday's eruption of Java's highest volcano. Search and rescue efforts were temporarily suspended Sunday afternoon because of fears that heavy rain would cause more hot ash and debris to fall from the crater. Mount Semeru has remained active since Saturday, with small eruptions keeping emergency workers and residents on edge. Officials have advised locals not to travel within 5 kilometers of Semeru's crater, as the nearby air is highly polluted and could affect vulnerable groups. The body of Senator Bob Dole of Kansas will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol on Thursday as congressional leaders honor the former Republican presidential candidate and World War II veteran. He served in Congress for 36 years. Dole died Sunday at the age of 98. He shaped tax and foreign policy and worked vigorously to help the disabled. Senate leaders, both Republican and Democrat, spoke of his legacy on Monday. Senator Mitch McConnell and Senator Chuck Schumer.
The whole country stands with you, not only in grief, but in gladness and thanksgiving for almost a century that was lived so patriotically, so gratefully, and so well.
While he frequently sparred with Democrats, some of his greatest achievements were bipartisan endeavors, including his work to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, legislation to strengthen Social Security, and revamping federal nutrition programs. Despite rising to the top ranks of his party, Senator Dole always kept close relationships with those on the other side of the aisle.
He was a leader known for his caustic wit, which he often turned on himself but didn't hesitate to turn on others too. The U.S. Capitol has been considered the most suitable place for the nation to pay final tribute to its most eminent citizens by having their remains lie in state. Making headlines in Asia, China's Uyghur Muslim ethnic group, which has a wide presence in Turkey, welcomed the U.S. boycott of the Beijing Winter Games. About 50,000 Uyghurs are believed to live in Turkey, the largest Uyghur diaspora outside of Central Asia. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia.
This is Science in a Minute.
There are said to be dozens of smaller so-called satellite galaxies that surround and are gravitationally bound to the Milky Way. A number of these galaxies are considered dwarf galaxies. Unlike the Milky Way with its estimated 100,000 million stars, dwarf galaxies are much smaller and can contain up to several billion stars. A team of astronomers at the University of Texas Austin says in a new paper that they have found an enormous black hole at the center of a dwarf galaxy called Leo 1. At the heart of the Milky Way, scientists say there is a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star. The Texan astronomers say they have found evidence that Leo 1's black hole is almost as massive as the one in our galaxy. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Finally on VOA Asia, two computer scientists at the University of Maryland have developed a new artificial intelligence system that evolves to detect and evade internet censorship in repressive countries. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
Repressive governments around the world monitor and control internet traffic being sent and received by their citizens. Attempts to evade such censorship is a slow and cumbersome process. Often, researchers must manually search for ways to circumvent it.
Now we understand that these different countries will use a heterogeneous mix of different devices.
But computer scientists at the University of Maryland have developed artificial intelligence software called Geneva that learns how censoring technology is being used and adjusts in real time to circumvent it. Dave Levin is with the University of Maryland.
I think Geneva changes this cat and mouse game because it finally allows the evaders to react very, very quickly to changes in censorship.
Information on the internet is broken into data packets by the sender's computer and reassembled by the receiving computer. Repressive regimes monitor the data packets and block requests that either contain flagged words or prohibited domain names. Geneva automatically evolves to circumvent this type of censorship in a couple of ways. Dave Levin.
One way, it might make the censor think, oh, this isn't something that needs to be censored. This is fine. I'll let it happen. Or it tricks the censor into thinking that it did tear down the connection, that it stopped the communication, when in fact it didn't really.
For example, Kevin Bach is a PhD student at the University of Maryland who inspired the project for the team.
About a year ago, China deployed a totally new censorship system to try and interrupt specific types of secure communications, and took our software only about an hour to come up with ways to defeat it.
What's more, users don't have to install Geneva. It can run on the background of a web browser. Dave Levin.
This was very important to us because it means that people can evade censorship without having to take on any danger of installing anti-censorship software in the first place.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, College Park, Maryland.
Read and see more on this story at VOA Asia Facebook. That's all the time we have for today's VOA Asia. Make sure you find us on all our social media platforms. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can also find us on Instagram, YouTube, and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Jessica Stone. I'm Chris Cascale in Washington. Enjoy the day, stay safe, and be well.